All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksicles? That's a summer one. I just decided on it. How's it going? Today on the show, I talked to Vanessa Hollingshead. Vanessa Hollingshead and I go way back. Way back to New York, back in the day. She's a little younger than me, and I remember her starting out. She started after me, but she made like a very big impact. She did a lot of big character stuff, a lot of like, I thought she was going to be like the new Lucille Ball. She just had a lot going on, and then I didn't hear from her or see her for a long time. I'd heard weird stuff. I didn't know what was happening with her. I was recently going through my memory, checking in with everybody I once knew in my mind. I think I'd gotten an email from somebody who had been on a ship working with her. She does comedy on boats now. And I was just curious as to how, you know, what happened to her life? You know, is she okay? What's she doing comedy-wise? I mean, she was married to the owner of the comic strip. Not the owner, the guy who booked the comic strip, Lucian Hold, for years, and he passed away. It was one of those stories where I'm like, where did that woman go? And she's been out there working, doing a lot of cruise ships and stuff, but it's a very harrowing tale of comedy. It's one of those ones, and it was great to see her, and I'm glad we caught up. So that's going to happen in a minute. You're going to hear it. I got a couple emails about the Hawaii volcano statements I made the other day. One of them... helping out, and the other one saying, like, could you shut up? Tourism is our most important industry in Hawaii, all right? If people want to play golf in the lava, let them play golf in the lava. Who are you to ruin a luau in the lava? Wait, why are you getting all upset that you don't want to scuba dive in hot, steamy, sulfuric acid air water? Come on. Just because you're a pussy. I'm sorry, is it not good to use that word? Just because you're a weenus doesn't mean other people don't want to enjoy the nice... healing effects of freshly boiled lava water while they're snorkeling. All right, so let's talk about volcanoes for a minute. I made some jokes I just did on this show again, and I told you I did get one email from someone just saying, take it easy. The volcanoes on a small part of the island, it's not having a tremendous effect on most of the island, and we require tourists. There's the email. Subject line, volcanoes. Hey, Mark, I'm Jeremy, and I love the podcast, and I thought the David Harbour episode was great. I'm not trying to correct you. I guess I thought you would like to know about the two kinds of volcano eruptions that can occur. Simply put, volcanoes like the Hawaiian Islands ooze lava slowly and constantly over many, many years, building islands while at it. Lava rarely gets more dangerous than persons walking away could deal with. The other kind, like that of Vesuvius, the one that caused the famous Pompeii disaster, are much more dangerous. They are called pyroclastic volcanoes and build pressure inside until it actually explodes with ash, gases, and bits of solid rock. All burning very hot, and the pyroclastic clouds are sometimes over 100 miles an hour. Volcanoes like Hawaii will never explode with deadly gases, and volcanoes like Pompeii will never dribble lava. Cool, right? Just another reason you'll find a cool correlation of where the different kinds are. Loved your show, Marin. Love Glow. I've got a crush on Allison, but you are my favorite on the show. And the podcast is my favorite thing to listen to twice a week on my crappy ride to my crappier job. Keep fighting the good fight, man. Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for clearing up the volcano question. Yeah, I think that's interesting, though, that perhaps if there are going to be fatalities or many fatalities from the Hawaiian volcano, it'll just be people like going, come here, dude, just get closer. Get the picture. I'm going to do a selfie with the lava. Oh, you can't really see it. Hold on. Oh, fuck! Yeah, something like that. Right? Something like that. Also, you mentioned the David Harbour episode, which I enjoyed very much. Oh, see, this is the interesting thing, is I do a long conversation with David Harbour, and we talk candidly about struggles with mental illness, his being a little more extreme than mine, him talking about hospitalization, about medication, and being sort of open about it, which gets attention both in a good way and a bad way. Like, it's very helpful to destigmatize mental illness and talk candidly about it. I've been doing it here for years, and many of my guests have as well. But the issue is it's not going to bother David at all. He doesn't mind, but the clickbait fucking cancer spreaders, the malignant clickbaitists, let's just call them that. I mean, you know, it's just like they just everywhere. Harbor and Mental Institution, Harbor and Mental Hospital, Harbor, quote, I was committed to a mental asylum. It's just like just shit tons of clickbait taken out of context. Even if people don't read that article, which many people don't, they just, you know, glance past it and then make mental note of the clickbait and bring it up somewhere else and talk to somebody else who doesn't know shit about it. Takes it out of context and actually does the exact opposite of what we did on the show. It sort of stigmatizes mental illness because of the sordid approach of the attention-grabbing garbage headline. Some of them were thorough in the way they covered the episode, but many just wanted people to plant that in their head. Just the malignant meme machine. And I, you know, I'm guilty of taking that stuff in. I mean, hearsay is, in a lot of ways, you don't even realize it's, you know, it's sticking in your brain until you go, oh yeah, I heard that he was in a mental hospital. Yeah, I saw that article. Did you read it? Nah, but it must be, you know, he must be sick or what. It's just everyone's guilty of it. It's just a shame that. One of the things that I do here, one of the things that many people don't have time to do anymore, don't make time to do, is talk long enough and thorough enough and emotionally connected enough to sort of move through a lot of human problems, human issues, human interests and excitements, the process of people and how they live their life. And it just can be minimized to garbage in seconds by somebody who claims to be a journalist. What kind of people are those going to become? What kind of people that are just these strange, predatory, bottom-feeding, maybe college graduates whose job it is working at whatever web publication they work at to sort of take something, crunch it down, rip it out of context, and think of a kind of cracky little headline for it? Where do they go on to? What's their big future? Is that where they stop? Do they call themselves journalists and in an era where journalism it really has been phenomenal, the type of real work that journalists do. What do the clickbaitists think of themselves? Do they think they're heading in that direction where they might actually do something thorough and honest and probing and answering all the journalistic questions with all the scope of what is necessary to create a good piece of journalism? Or are they just going to be Marin shits on journalism? I just wrote a piece for them, but it is disconcerting and sad that the cultural dialogue continues to digress to we're just going to be, you know, just angry apes spewing bits and pieces, fragments of larger stories, completely out of context, just blathering down the street, gurgling things. Trump, lava, porn star. Golf. I went to IKEA to get curtain rods, and I ended up buying a large patio umbrella. That's the kind of thing that can happen there. I just need a container for my thing. Oh, look what I got. Everything's so cheap, it's just disposable. Got a large patio umbrella. That I don't even know. The great thing about so much that is made today, if you can accept it, is that when you buy it and you take it out of the box and you put it together, the first thought you have is, look at that piece of garbage. Looks okay, but it's really garbage. And you just wait for it to become actual garbage. So did I tell you a little bit about me and Vanessa's history? But it was interesting to talk to her because I hadn't seen her in a long time, and she has been through quite an ordeal. And she did come out on the other side of it, and she is working, and she's doing, you know, I've only talked to a couple of ship comics, and it's an interesting life, an interesting world, but her journey all the way from childhood through to where she is now, I had no idea. I had no idea the depth and scope of what she'd been through and where she'd been in the last few years and what she's been doing, because she's one of those comics that was like, she was about to happen. And just a series of events shifted the trajectory of her life. This is me talking to Vanessa Hollingshead. I should mention that she had laryngitis when she was here. That was bad timing. So if you go see her doing stand-up in New York or on the road, it's likely she will not sound like this. So this is me and Vanessa Hollingshead. what do you do? Like, who's that guy out there?
My friend Jeff. He actually...
Oh, he's just a buddy of yours? He lives out here?
When I got my first development deal,
yeah,
he wrote the show, and then I turned down the Drew Carey show, and that was to cost me... I remember Lucian said, well, you might have shot your last wad, honey, and you might never get another chance. But just get really funny.
Great. Thanks, pal.
Like, thank you, Lucian.
Well, I mean, I don't know what you've been doing, but I do remember there was a time where we were all sort of... Where did you come from? Because I remember that you got some big opportunities, just like you were saying, Drew Carey show and whatever. And we can talk about that. But I remember there was a time... When did you start doing comedy?
I did comedy in 92. I was trained to be a Shakespearean actress.
Well, where'd you grow up?
New York City and then in England. My dad actually brought LSD into the country and gave it to Timothy Leary.
Your dad was the guy who did that?
Yeah, he was the guy that did that.
But was he a scientist or chemist or drug dealer?
He was a drug addict, alcoholic.
But was he a drug advocate? I mean, at that time... I mean, yes. LSD was sort of had supposedly mystical qualities. What was his trip? Did he live long? Do you remember him?
Yes, I remember him. Him and Tim Leary and Bill W. Believe it or not, Bill W. was experimenting with LSD. They had the Concord Prison Experiment.
Bill W. from AA.
From AA, that people got upset when he was taking acid because I was like. If you took acid for one day, did you lose your sobriety? And they were like, yes. But I'm like, but Bill W. took it. And like, well, they're upset.
He was
with
trying
it.
To cure alcoholism.
Yes. And he noticed. And I wanted to see God.
Yeah.
But he, in the end, he said, you can, and same with Baba Ram Dass. Baba Ram, I actually took LSD by accident when I was 5.
Really?
Yes.
And Baba Ram Dass, what's
he
his?
Gave me the shot of Thorazine, Richard Alpert.
Yeah, Richard Alpert. He was hanging out. So your dad was in New York City, or was this in London?
No, my dad was in New York. He was, he got the LSD from Albert Hoffman.
From Switzerland. From Switzerland, the original LSD.
It's LSD, it's called lysergic dilinamide acid 25, because the 25th batch, is, Albert Hoffman was just experimenting. And he sneezed, breathed, it's from the ergot, from a rye seed.
Yeah.
Just sneezed, went on his nose. He was bicycling through the streets of Basel, Switzerland. And the next time he was stripping his brains out.
Yeah.
So he got, that was LSD 25.
Right.
Got it to Huxley, who was writing The Doors of Perception.
Right.
My dad was friends with Huxley.
So your dad's from England.
From England. Yeah, from Darlington. And
how was he in with Huxley and all these guys?
Because he was a writer.
Okay.
And my dad wrote the book, The Man Who Turned On the World. And then my dad, Leary, got all the credit.
Was that a successful book?
It was pretty successful. They knew him in England, and he gave LSD to Paul McCartney. In England. And Paul McCartney, and they were getting the book, The Tibetan Book of the Dead.
Yeah.
So there's a song on the Beatles called Tomorrow Never Knows.
Yeah.
Because I know... My dad wanted to meet John Lennon.
Yeah.
And he only could meet Paul. I'm sure he was like, well,
I'll take Paul.
I'll take Paul. I really want John, but Paul will do. Who knows? And
he thought John would enjoy the acid more?
I think he'd enjoy John more because John was more of a rebel. And my dad was a rebel.
Yeah.
And so they got, he got the Tibetan Book of the Dead to John. And Tomorrow Never Knows was inspired from taking LSD.
All right, so then your dad comes here, and what, he's hanging out up at the mansion?
No, this is early 60s.
Right.
He's already, they got the acid early 60s.
Yeah.
It was right before the Summer of Love when everything exploded. But my dad had to get this acid to somebody, and Tim Leary was a psychologist at Harvard, and he was experimenting experimenting with psilocybin mushrooms. Yeah. And my dad... was such a conniver. He was very shrewd. He could meet anybody.
Yeah.
And someone said, Huxley said, meet this chap, Tim Leary.
Yeah.
So he goes to meet Tim Leary and he threatens to kill himself. And Tim Leary said, I think he's a sociopath. And my dad said, you've got to try this LSD. Yeah. It'll run, it's nothing like your magic mushrooms. Yeah. And he was smart. He was a real ladies' man. So Flo Ferguson was Maynard Ferguson's wife.
The trumpet player?
Yes.
Yeah.
So he said, can you put me up? You know, I came all the way. And Tim wanted to be nice, and Tim was like, just get rid of the guy.
And the annoying British guy with the chemical.
That I think is a sociopath. Yeah. There's something off about him. But Tim was a psychologist, so he knew.
And so he was right?
Yeah. I had the joy of having him as a father.
Right. So, but were you born at this point?
Yeah. I was born in 1960, right when all this stuff was happening. And at 5 was when they had Millbrook Mansion. And 5
Millbrook
was when,
upstate New York.
When they put the LSD on the sugar cubes. Yeah. And my mom wouldn't let me have any candy. And I just kept eating the sugar cubes.
So, okay, so your dad turns Leary on. And Leary, I guess, changes his mind about your dad.
Well, Flo Ferguson. My dad gets a hold of Flo Ferguson. Yeah. That's in the house in Cambridge.
Right.
And
this is the house where all these people are hanging out, coming and going. Richard Alpert and that whole bunch.
Right. Yeah. And Tim is, I think, working at Harvard.
Yeah.
And Flo says, Tim, you got to try this stuff.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
He loved Flo.
Yeah.
So he takes the acid and he's like, you know what? I think I was wrong about you. Yeah. I think this is.
Yeah, yeah. You seem
and
great.
And
your hair is electric.
Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And he called him the Divine Rascal.
That's what your dad was?
He was called Divine Rascal.
So he kind of followed that crew up to Millbrook and you followed up to Millbrook and then you got dosed when you were.
Well, my mom didn't know what to do with me. She was very upset. She was actually.
But she's not British?
She was American. She said, when I met your father, I hated all men. And after I married him, I hated everybody.
What'd she do?
She was his secretary. And she met my dad at Oxford University Press. And she just wanted to be a mom.
Yeah.
She was madly in love with him.
Yeah.
And he was a bit of a player. So that marriage went south. My dad.
How quickly, though? How old were you?
Like one. And he was already seeing other women. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was. And I have a stepsister and a stepbrother. And
so when you, why were you, if he was off and running, why were you in New York? Were you in his custody or?
My mom said, I'm putting Vanessa up for adoption. I can't take care of her. And my dad said, bring her to, let her have some fresh air in the country. Uh-huh. The country will do her good. And there was hippies.
Millbrook Mansion.
Yeah, there was rooms filled with, they would experiment. They would take an iguana and a rabbit and a monkey and give them all acid, see how they did.
And a baby.
And a baby. Yeah, one or two. Baby, some candy.
Yeah. Well, so you're up there, and how old are you at that moment?
5.
You're 5, so you have vague memories? Or
no, I remember like something was really wrong that day, but we had a...
The
day I took the acid, I remember like I was jumping. My dad was now seeing this woman, Britta. And I remember I used to love the trampoline. And I remember jumping up and down on the trampoline. And all of a sudden, I just saw fluorescent worms everywhere. And I remember going to see my dad. And I started screaming for Britta. And we had Alex. I think Alex was Maynard Ferguson's son. We both saw the same thing. And I remember she grabbed me in one hand and Alex in the other. And I looked at my dad and I said, Dad, look at the pictures ripping. Look at my nails getting smaller. And my dad was like, oh, fuck, she got into the acid.
Yeah.
And he didn't know how many trips I took because they used to leave it on sugar cubes. So he said, I said, do you remember what happened that day? He goes, I remember I drove you for like, must have been 12 hours, and you just said, look at the purple trees, and I was mortified that you might have brain damage.
Oh, and so he cared.
Yeah, I was like, well, thanks, Dad, thank you. And then he got me to Richard Alpert, had a little shack in Millbrook Mansion, and he was just coming into his, I think, homosexuality. It was very taboo. And Richard Alpert had like a bag of tricks and just, I remember getting the shot of Thorazine. I remember like, I remember my dad picking me up like this and the shot and I was out and that was it.
Wow. So they just knocked you out.
Knocked me right out.
And you processed it, you woke up, you were okay?
Yeah, it was great. I just became a comedian, had nothing but dysfunctional relationships afterwards and hated myself. Yeah, no, it worked out great.
You trace it back to that? Well, I mean, so you're 5 then. So how do you grow up? You grow up with him? Or why did your mother think she couldn't take care of you?
She was starting to come a little bit unglued. Ended up being in and out of many foster homes.
You did?
Yeah. And my dad was now... they were starting to crack down on Millbrook Mansion. That was the introduction of MK Ultra and the CIA.
So they took the acid. They got hold of
the Gordon Liddy. Remember Gordon Liddy surrounded? Yeah. And then Gordon Liddy and Leary ended up being on tour. Like, they did a comedy show together.
But once acid was introduced and the CIA got a hold of it, they started to do the experiments to see what it was.
They wanted it to be a truth serum. Now, this was, my dad, ended up going back to England because he wanted to take, he was going to be the London affiliate.
Yeah, so of MK Ultra?
No, of the LSD when all this was happening. So he had 25 hours, I think the CIA said, you either tell us what you know, you have 24 hours to get out of the country.
Yeah.
So when he got back to England, he started to get addicted to methamphetamine. My dad had a really bad, he had untreated alcoholism and methamphetamine issues. So he got addicted to the methamphetamine. This is when he gave Paul McCartney the LSD.
Yeah.
And for two roaches, got sentenced to 16 years in Wormwood. Does that sound like a Dickens? Wormwood prison. And he decided to be his own lawyer. When he was high on acid, and it got him another like 6 months. He heard the police getting ready to come, and you know, in England, you flush the loo, and there's two.
Yeah.
Flush the loo, and the two roaches joints came up from the bathroom, and the police officer's like, "Well, what seems to be here? Looks to be marijuana roaches." And then my dad said, "Well, isn't that where they belong? In the toilet?" And that just
that was it.
Cost him. Yeah.
So he went to jail for a while.
16 months.
And you, and then that's when he started going into foster homes, or?
Well, I was going in and out of them. At two, my mother put me up for adoption. Then three, I was back with her. Then four, I was with her somewhere else. Then five, a little bit at Millbrook.
Did she have mental problems?
No, she was completely sane.
Yeah, but I mean, like what was her trip? I mean, she just couldn't.
Oh, I don't know what her trip was.
Is she still alive?
No, she died in eight. She died 6 years ago. It was the first time we were close. I was kind of like her mom.
Yeah.
And my mother was like Blanche DuBois, but on drugs. My mother had gotten brutalized in Bed-Stuy. She'd gotten beaten. She'd gotten raped. And I was going to school, and I was trying to. And that's when I used to listen to music, the Beatles.
Yeah.
And pretend, you know, Paul or John marries me, I'll be out of this.
And your father was in jail, or you just weren't talking to him?
He was in jail, and no one knew. And my mother was so angry at him, she made sure he eventually found me, hired a detective, found me in Cambrai Island, and then lived on the commune. I mean, it was just a lot of...
What commune?
I lived in Dawes Hill Commune, got his girlfriend. He was now running the Free High Church in Cambrai Island, giving LSD.
Where is that?
That was off the island, coast of Scotland, Cambrai Island.
Oh, okay.
Giving LSD to...
Oh, so he was really doing the 60s.
He never got over this. I said, Dad, the 60s are gone.
Yeah.
They're done.
Yeah.
You need to move on.
Was he like the guru of this island? Was it a cult situation?
It wasn't a cult situation. He just so believed in... Him and Leary were idealists.
Yeah.
They believed if everyone could take LSD, they would see God and the world would be a better place.
Yeah.
And I said, but you're having a lot of crazy people and young people that don't have a shot living in Harlem and living in tenements without a shot. They're taking LSD and they're not getting the same vision.
Yeah.
You can control this substance with cute, blonde, hippie women that you can have sex with and lots of good food and great things to read. I said, not everyone has that opportunity.
You said that to him?
Yeah. He said, shut the fuck up, you straight fucking shit. I mean, he would just get so angry at me. And if I
How old were you when you were saying that stuff to
him? Oh, like 12.
Oh.
12, 13.
Oh, my God. So what were the foster homes like? I mean, what was that?
Oh, they were awful. They were awful. But the one home, thank God this woman, I lived at 410 Central Park West when I was two, when I was three, and Gracie, my best friend, was two. Her mother noticed that I would run around with very little clothes on, and she said, you used to knock on people's doors, and I don't have any recollection, asking people for food. You'd always be entertaining, and you became good friends with my little daughter, Gracie. And Gracie and I, to this day, we're still best friends. Really? I mean, we've got this, like, it's beyond sisters. Like, her mother saved my life. I know he said I will always take care of Gracie. But her mother said, I'll never forget, like, going over to your mother's place. And I'd missed a lot of school, and we were in Bed-Stuy now. And my mother had, like, her teeth knocked out. And I would have to go visit her, and I didn't know what would take place. Yeah. And then I had been brutalized. I remember, like, and this is when I just believed that there's got to be some God. I remember this gang of kids broke in, and I was, like, you know, 8. And I remember they just broke in, and I just was just, like, praying nothing would happen to me. And they said, where's the money? And I said, it's on the refrigerator, and it was just, like, 35 cents. And
yeah.
They went, oh, shit. And they threw the change on the floor, and they just walked out. And I remember thinking, something has got to be looking out for me. But Big Ray said, you would miss almost 6 months of school. You were going to put you in a foster home, and you were too sensitive. You never would, no, a reform school. You never would have lasted.
Yeah.
So she took me in, and she changed
Gracie's
my entire
mom.
Gracie's mom changed my entire life. She was German. And I remember reading about the Holocaust and, you know, just reading about this. And I said, came home from school, I'm like, why did you kill 6 million Jews?
Yeah.
She was like, oh, we did not kill 6 million Jews. I mean, Hitler was Austrian. Yeah. We're German.
Uh-huh.
He did that. So I was like,
right.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. We had nothing to do with this.
We had nothing to do with that.
Sure. So that's where you primarily grow up with her family?
For 1 year. Then my dad finds me. He's in Cumbrae Island.
Right.
He becomes friends with this woman, Myra Coppersmith.
Yeah.
Crazy Jewish woman with just larger than life woman has like an affair with her and goes, you get Vanessa back. You just get her to Cumbrae Island and we just get her.
Yeah.
So she meets me. She's like a character. She ends up being completely Orthodox Jew, like marries, like she's now Miriam. She lives in Israel. And I ended up meeting Bob Dylan because her husband, Mayer, was good friends with Bob Dylan. So Miriam said, I'd love to be like your mother. And I remember she introduced me to James Taylor and Carole King and Brooklyn and like this whole world. And
was he on dope then? Was he a druggie? Was Myra a druggie?
No, Myra liked pot. I remember she liked pot. I remember she never wore a bra. And she had like the ohm sign. She was like she was hippie.
And her husband knew Dylan?
My husband met Dylan years later. She converted. She went from being reformed Orthodox Buddhist to being devout.
Full Orthodox.
Yeah.
And so, that's when Dylan was at too?
That Dylan was just, I remember meeting Dylan years ago, like in 1990, 1991. And she invites me over to a Seder, which I'd never been to. And there was Bob Dylan. And there was these three rabbis that were very funny. And I remember Bob Dylan, and he just completely fell right in his food. And I said to Miriam, I said, I think this is on, I think he's on something stronger than Manischewitz wine.
Yeah.
This is.
He fell in his food?
Fell right in his food. But I'll never forget, we were both washing our hands. And we had to like wash the hands, and I was like, this is fucking Bob Dylan. And I was like, I couldn't. You know, like when you met, you're talking to Keith,
you just get all excited.
And it's like, hey. I love Lay Lady Lay. Lay, that's a, so he goes, thank you. He goes, what do you do? I'm like, I just started doing comedy. He's like, wow, that's brave. I'm like, he said, that's brave.
Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan thought I was brave.
So that was that late. So you'd already started doing comedy when you were...
I was just six months in.
So that relationship with Myra sort of like evolved, but you stayed with Big and Little Grace for a while. And then like, where did you end up, you know, towards...
Well, the commune, my dad. Miriam put me in this commune and there were all the draft dodgers. Myra became Miriam.
Yeah, yeah.
There were all the draft dodgers from Cornell University in Ithaca. And she said... She's like, I will be like the mother you never had and take care of you. So I get to this commune. There's no electricity. I'm this kid from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
I love bologna sandwiches
yeah.
and hot pants and Barbie dolls. Yeah. And there's milk the goats. You've got to pump water for the well.
Yeah.
Like they're growing pot everywhere. People are having sex. They're doing drugs.
Yeah.
Like, this is really...
Too much, huh?
Too much. And I had to live in my own yurt, build my own firewood. And I'm like, wow, I got all the skills if I ever had to, like, go to Siberia.
go off the grid.
Right.
Yeah.
So they didn't, she never told me this. They asked her to leave. They said, after like 2 weeks, they said, you leave, but we want the little girl to stay. I thought Myra didn't want me.
Oh. And your dad's there too, right?
No, my dad is furious with Myra because Myra said, listen, I was supposed to bring you back to Cambrai Island, but your dad's not very nice. He's mean. He's got a dark side.
Yeah.
And I remember my mother saying, he's got a dark side.
Yeah.
So in a year later, my dad drove up to the commune and flipped out and he goes, the reason why this commune exists because of me, because I gave you acid, all this fucking free fucking love is me.
Yeah.
Just leave me the fuck alone or I'll shoot all of you fucking fucks. So that was my dad.
Yeah.
We're at the commune. So he's holed up in this yurt like thing and everyone's being very polite with him. And they're like, dude, you know, your dad's really violent. And then he says to me, you have your choice. He goes, listen, Vanessa, you have a choice. You could either stay at this commune or you can come to Boston. If you stay at the commune, you'll never, ever fucking see me again or come to Boston, Cambridge.
Yeah.
So I was now fitting in the commune.
How old were you?
I was 12 now.
Yeah.
And 1973, 74, 13.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I was kind of reunited with my dad again and I didn't, you know, when you have not had a father or a mother and you could look at something and know it's your blood.
Right.
Just even if it's drunk blood, high blood,
right.
whatever. Sure. I could look at my dad's eyes and go, I know those eyes.
Yeah.
And I loved him. I looked up. My mom was like an enigma. And my mom always told me, I never really got jealous of women because my mom said, you can be anyone you want to be and look however you want to look. And all I ever want to do is look like her.
Right.
And, you know, without the teeth being knocked out, the bra over her dress. And
so you go to Boston.
So I go to Boston and they just started the busing. There was so much racism and anti-Semitism and just disgusting. Like, I grew up with black kids. There was no prejudice or, you know, lived in black neighborhoods. So my dad sent me to private school, said, I don't want anyone to beat the shit out of you. And he was now with this new woman, Oriel. So now I'm introduced to what it's like to be with an alcoholic, the likes I hadn't seen.
Yeah.
And he had two sides to him. And when my dad was on, he was as charming as can be.
Yeah.
And the dark side, he would punch holes through the wall. He took my guitar once, you know, smashed it. And then I remember he said, you know, the next time I drink a little too much, just put on the Beatles, we can work it out. I'm like, is that before or after you smash my phonograph? Just tell me. So I learned really young, if I was sarcastic and didn't raise my voice, I could say how I spoke. If I got loud with my dad, because I was seething, I was enraged that he left us.
Yeah.
It would get violent. So I think those were the roots of...
Did he hit you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not a lot.
Yeah.
Nothing like out of I, Tonya or anything.
Right. So you go through high school in Boston?
Yeah, I finished high school in a year and a half, finished prep school, graduate with honors.
Yeah.
And then my dad decides he hates Americans. He was always, we get to England, he hated the English. We get to America, he hated Americans.
Right.
So he leaves me in Boston, and now I'm like kind of homeless for a few months, and then I rejoin him in London. But I had friends by now, but I was now experimenting, you know, I lost my virginity very early.
How old?
13.
How'd that happen?
This older kid.
Yeah.
and I was drinking, and I was very little alcohol. I would always get sick.
Yeah.
And then I slept with my, I slept with one of my teachers.
At prep school?
Yeah.
When you were?
13, 14.
Really?
And I didn't know. He could have gotten a lot of trouble. I really did keep, I really never reported him.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget, I won the philosophy award.
Do you regret not reporting him? Or
no, you know what? I don't. I now like, you know what? I don't. But you know, when you've been like wrongly touched and mistreated, like it's. I was talking to somebody about sexual predators. Like for someone who survived it, if Harvey Weinstein would have said, "Listen, do you mind watching me take a shower naked?" I'm like, "You're gonna make me sixth lead in your movie? Here's the soap, here's the towel. Yeah. You're my guest,
right?
You know, but." My friend Jeannie said, when you haven't been touched inappropriately, it's inappropriate. When someone's been touched inappropriately, they don't know the difference, and it's all about survival.
There's no boundary there.
There's no boundary.
Hmm. So you're saying that you were a few months on your own, homeless, and you started doing drugs and stuff? Or
no, I never. I went back to the commune, and I couldn't go back.
Oh, my God. So who's flying you back and forth?
No, my friend... Frank Moss, who was from the commune. I was in New York. I ended up going to Ithaca. He paid for my bus ticket.
From Boston.
Yeah, now I'm like 15. I'm out of high school, finish early. I'm starting to put on a lot of weight. I don't know what's going on. I'm coming into, I'm not really drinking or drugging that much. I'm really, I just wanted to look like a skinny model, you know, and I just was so unsure of myself, and I went back to the commune, and you couldn't go back. So I ended up staying with my friend Estelin, who lived on the commune, and I got a job as a dishwasher. I was trying to get waitress work, and I was so shy. I was painfully shy. I would walk in and I'm like, looking for anybody to... And Esalen said, why don't you use your acting ability?
Yeah.
You just go into a... I said, what? She goes, yeah, talk with a British accent. Like, talk with a British accent.
Is that
like,
something you did with her, like, for fun?
All the time. I was always, hello. And so I said, I was wondering if you were looking for any waitresses. I just came from London and would really like to work here. And he's like, well, you don't need any waitresses. We need a dishwasher. Fine, I'll take it. I'll be a dishwasher.
You'll be a dishwasher and you had to do the accent?
For 8 hours. I had so much. I was so afraid. I said, Esalen, I got the job, but I'm a dishwasher. But for 8 hours, I'm talking a British accent.
Right.
She's like, tell them you were so desperate. I'm like, no.
You got to commit.
I can't. Like,
the role of a lifetime.
And then I told my dad. My dad's laughing on the phone.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you find this funny, Dad?
Yeah.
This is my acting role? Yeah. This is the world? This is my oyster?
Yeah.
Like, well, who knows? This would be a wonderful story, darling. And you'll work on your accent. And who knows? It's quite funny, really. I mean, for you.
Work on your accent.
And you just kept
wonderful
laughing.
Wonderful story.
Yes. I called it Big Race. It was like, my savior, saving grace. I'm like, I'm a dishwasher in Rochester with a British accent. And it's like, you just come back to Brooklyn. We'll figure something out. And she sees me. And I'm like, black hair, magenta lipstick, 50 pounds heavier. And I remember, hi, Big Race. And she was like,
terrified. Like, what happened to you?
And she goes, you look healthy.
Yeah.
I'm like, that means fat.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, we're put you on a, no, we're gonna see good nutritionist. And she said, now you have your choice. You're either gonna go to Betty Owens secretarial school.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, I'm meant to be great. I was meant to be. Yeah. Or you could be a hairdresser, because I used to give my doll share haircuts.
Uh-huh.
So I went to Betty Owens secretarial school, and she goes, one day when you get ready to win your Oscar, you go thank your typewriter.
Uh-huh.
So I was the slowest one in the class, but I typed like 22 words a minute, but never knowing it'd be like my saving grace. And I used to get nervous when I'd have to take typing tests, because I was with MTV. I was a trying to go to, now I got a scholarship to Lee Strasberg. I got accepted at NYU.
How'd that all happen?
I auditioned for Lee Strasberg Theatrical Institute.
When
I was 18.
After you did the secretarial school, you got a job in the city and you were going in
to work? I was now a temp all over the offices in New York, and I would always fail at the typing test. So right. I learned how to see the test, know that they would turn it around. It used to be a lot easier to cheat.
Yeah.
So I would take the actual test
slowly
and say, I'm ready for my typing test, and it would be the actual, and I remember like...
I was already written down.
I remember getting in an MTV. I was at MTV when that just opened with the... Temping there. And they said, wow, you type 76 words a minute. I'm like...
Yeah. So when did you audition at Strasberg?
Strasberg was when I was 18.
And this is when you were temping and stuff?
I just started temping. I had to work before I could get my typing up. I was working as a cashier. I had to work as a sandwich maker. I had to get my typing skills up, and I knew that if someone would hire me, I would practice.
Yeah.
So that's why I had to cheat. And then Big Race was like, if you gotta lie to survive, you do what you gotta do. But right. Don't lie unless it's to survive. Then you can lie. Okay. So I was like, all right.
Thanks for the wisdom. So what happened to Strasberg?
Strasberg was the most...
You got in, that you auditioned?
I got in. When I got in, I was so happy. I studied with Al Pacino's teacher, Charlie Lawton.
Oh, yeah?
I just wanted...
For how long? How long were you there?
Like 4 years.
Really? So you auditioned there, or you went there to work as a temp?
No, I auditioned there. First class I had to pay for... And it was
I see. So then they offered you, like, you could work and...
Well, my teacher said she's talented. She put in a word for me, uh-huh. And that was Barbara Portier. That was Sidney Poitier's cousin. And I remember thinking that I went... She said, do you know why you're in my class? And I said, well, obviously, because they must have seen something.
Yeah.
And it killed her. She goes... No, they thought you had some emotional issues because you were painfully shy, uh-huh. And I'm a psychologist and an acting teacher, and they thought you'd do well with me.
Right.
That was hard. And then I started to excel, but I remember the first time I learned about method acting, it was humiliating because I thought, you just think you're talented, you know, you just think that you've got something.
Yeah.
And I'm doing my monologue, I'm overacting, and I'm just like, and then the train, and this came, and no one looked, no one even gave a damn.
Yeah.
Scene, and she bursts out laughing. My teacher bursts out laughing, the students burst out laughing, and I start to feel the heat, you know, when the heat starts to.
Yeah.
And she's like, Van, I'm gonna call you Van, I want you to do that again, but just say it.
Yeah.
Just say it. Say the words. I'm like, but there's blood in it. Just say the words. Just speak. And I started to speak, and I started to feel connected with what I was speaking, and the emotions just came out of something organic. And she said, that is the beginning of acting.
Uh-huh.
And that was like the beginning. That was the journey. You know?
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're there for 4 years.
4 years.
And then when and how did you start doing comedy? Did you go? Was the only school you did was the Method Studio? Was with Strasberg or
was Method? And then my teacher was like, you know, use this when you need it.
Yeah.
If you're emotional, don't. This is now. Throw out everything you learned.
Right.
You know, when you get taught that, like, learn all this, and throw it out.
Right.
So now I was in my early 20s.
Yeah.
My dad was now on to the next woman. My sister was already born. He met a woman in London. I moved back with him briefly in London. Then he moved. He lived at 355 Mercer Street, and he gives me that place. And I'm living with, again, all these hippies. You can hear them having sex.
Yeah.
And it was just,
But you're in your 20s now.
I'm in my 20s.
Yeah.
I'm working like a dog. I'm working like 80 hours at Dean and DeLuca for my acting
class. What year,
class.
90 something?
This was now 89, 90.
Yeah, right.
And No, 80, like the 80s.
Yeah.
The 80s. And long story short, 1984, he dies. Big Race dies. My life is, like...
Your old man dies and Big Race
the
dies?
Same year.
Yeah.
The same year. And I'd been in a fight with Big Race. We'd never fought. If we did, we always made up. And I was... That was a Tuesday. We fought on a Tuesday, and I couldn't stand not getting along with her. And I went to call her on Thursday, and they said, she's gone. She died. She ended up having like a leg amputated. She didn't know she had diabetes. And I never got to say I loved her. And then my dad was screaming at me for his old girlfriend. Never got to say I loved him. So he was just screaming. And then I had no idea.
How'd he die?
He died in Bolivia. I believe it was from a bleeding ulcer, but I believe it was due to, he said they were running a jojoba plantation, which I think they were running a cocaine plantation, and jojoba covered it, but he was getting thinner, and he'd send me pictures. He used to write really tiny, because in prison, he learned how to write really well.
Yeah.
His writing was now getting, like, just erratic,
yeah.
And he was getting thinner and thinner, and I remember thinking, something's not good here.
Yeah.
And he passed away, and we were always fighting by this point. And Big Race helped me through. Big Race said, he's like Rumpelstiltskin. Can you see him like as a cartoon character?
Yeah.
Just see him as a cartoon character.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, he'd start yelling. She had a horn. She's like, just blast him with this horn. So I remember like my dad screaming at me. I'm like, Dad, can you hold on a second? Yeah, what? What the fuck? Just
an air horn?
Air horn.
Yeah.
And then we just start laughing. But she took away the... She helped, like, she humanized the whole situation. She made him more cartoon-like,
yeah.
Which made my rage and his insanity more palpable.
And they both die in the same year.
Same year.
It's terrible.
That was a shitty year.
And that was, like, in the
80s. In 1984. Right. And my dad said, the world is going to end in 1984. And his world was going to end in 1984. It's like he saw his own premonition. And I'll never forget when Big Race died, my mother and I went up to the roof. I was listening to Wishing You Were Here by Chicago. And she said, you must feel like you lost your own mother. She's more of a mom than I ever was. I was like, yeah, but you're still my mom. You'll always be my mom. But it almost took me 2 years to recover from that. And so I was to associate, as I began to understand recovery, addiction, codependency.
You started going to meetings?
I started going to meetings.
Which kind?
I was potential drinker.
You were drinking?
Very little. But I knew, I was like, I can't be like my dad. I cannot. So I was barely had a problem. But something said, just go to a meeting.
Yeah.
And then at 29, I was in Astoria. I just wanted to be a cop on a series. I just wanted to act. Now I'm like just a secretary. Like, this is.
You were living in Astoria?
Living in Astoria. My friend said, you know what? When you tell me what your day at work is, it's so much funnier than shit I see on TV. You should be a comedian. I'm like, oh, stop. What? No. She goes, I'm telling you, you're funny. I'm like, that's because, you know, you love me. I'm telling you, you're funny. Just try it. I'm like, come. And I'll never forget, that was 1992.
Yeah.
Within 2 years, I had a development deal. And everything came together.
Where'd you go on first? So how'd you start?
Gladys's Comedy Club. And I brought all the girls from the office.
Yeah.
And I went on like 4 hours later. And I remember getting on stage going, no one even laugh at Richard Pryor if he came on at this point. The second I was on stage, I was like, I'm home.
Yeah.
Like no one could take this away from me because I would always be doing plays if I could, but I was always like the director, the actor. And then I was a musician too. I was always getting the band together, learning the songs, trying to get the gigs. And I'm like, if I do this on my own, no one, I can only let myself down. and I could be independent, and I won't need to rely on anybody for anything. I won't need anybody.
I remember seeing you around early on, I guess at the Strip or Stand Up New York, and you did some, you were a big, brassy act, and you did some characters, right? And, but you were definitely, like sort of high energy, and like you really got the crowd, you know, and that was like right from the beginning you were doing it like that?
Yeah. Well, I went to audition for Lucian.
Lucian Hold.
My friend said.
Booker of the comic strip. Booker and part owner, right?
Was part he part owner? Yeah. No, not part owner. He wanted to be. They never let him.
Oh, really?
They really, yeah.
He was there a million years. They never let him get a piece of it?
They never let him. And he always, I'll never forget when he got deathly ill. And I said, Lucian, you've got to let them know you need help.
Yeah.
You can't go on like this. And I was like basically a nurse by now and bandaging him up. And he's like, no, they can't know because I might lose my job. I'll lose my job. And it was the first time I was like, holy shit, you're vulnerable.
Yeah.
I felt like, you know, the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
right.
Oh, my God. Interesting.
But we'll get to that. So in 92, you start doing comedy in New York clubs. Did you get past? Where were you past? Where did you work in?
Doing gay rooms. I couldn't get any. Michelle Ballin. Do you know Michelle Ballin?
I think I remember her.
She said, you can come up with us to Provincetown, but you have to do some gay songs and be gay.
Yeah.
I'm like, but I'm not gay. It's like, well, you're going to have to act gay because I'll get stage time.
Yeah.
So we had to do so I went up there and I was like, I got one of my jokes from there because I was like, wow, they're all going to come on to me. I mean, they'll just want me and I'll be straight. And not one of them looked my way. I will never forget that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Michelle said, because you don't smile. Wouldn't kill you to smile.
Yeah.
And then Lucian, they said, I was told he was Satan. He was Lucifer. He will. Don't get involved with him. He will destroy you.
This is the mid-90s, and he was the entryway to the comic strip.
Right.
And had been for years.
Yes.
Right?
And he saw himself. I'm the keeper at the gate.
Yeah.
I have to tell who comes in and who comes out. I used to think, God, this guy's really full of himself.
But did you audition for him?
Yes. I was in there for an hour. And Michelle said, I knew how badly you wanted to be passed at the comic strip. I thought you were blowing them. I'm like, no, that came later.
Yeah.
He passed me and he goes, you do these characters. I don't know anything about you. I'm like, yes, but I'm an actress. He goes, well, so you say. I mean, he was so, I go, well, but I am. Well, so you say. No offense. I don't know you.
Yeah.
Now, I want you to go on stage and just talk to the audience. I don't know what to, no, they're here to listen to me. No, they're there because you need to, I don't know what to say to an audience. It goes, where'd you get that tie? Where are you from? And I said, but I'm not going to get laughs. And I'll never forget. He goes, Vanessa, I'm giving you permission to bomb. And it was like one of the, so he let me kind of bomb. And I remember he goes.
And what did that do? How did that help you?
It made me feel there was at least someone in my corner. If I didn't do well, I'd get a spot. And he would only give me spots like a Tuesday night once every 8-9 weeks. And he was always talking politics and everyone was always talking. I would just have my notebook and be shy.
Yeah.
And he'd say, you should talk to people. It goes, are you a lesbian? I'm like, no. I'm smart. Why, if a guy comes in here with his notebook, he's straight, but if I sit here with my notebook, I'm a lesbian? He goes, well, you wear an army jacket, you have short hair, you have magenta lipstick, you don't talk to anyone, and you just told me that you were in Provincetown.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, okay, I could see that. And then Dennis Wolfberg was his dearest friend, and I was going to this church, and Lucian, no one knew this. I loved Lucian, I think, more than he loved. I loved him more than he loved me.
Yeah.
I, the,
He went to that Unitarian church.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was going to this other church, and they got this, like, Southern windbag minister.
Yeah.
And it was around Easter, and I just asked him what church he goes. He goes, oh, Unitarian Universalist. The only time you hear Jesus is if the janitor stubs his toe.
Yeah.
Would you like to join me for Easter? He just lost his best friend, Dennis Wolfberg.
Right,
he literally, and he liked me.
Yeah.
And all I'm hearing is, Satan, you'll be destroyed. All that work for nothing. You'll never, if you sleep with this guy, you're done. You're history.
Why was that? Why did people say that?
That's what they said. They were frightened. Men and women were intimidated by Lucian.
Yeah. All right, so you go to church with him.
Go to church with him, and then I'm starting to talk about, you can come up to the podium and speak. And my mother finally got hired at the welfare office. After being on welfare for 18 years, the welfare office finally gives her a job working at welfare. Lucian thought my hippie parent jokes, my mother stuff, he thought it was all, he said, you seem very well-rounded, grounded. He said, your parents really, I said, yeah. He goes, that wasn't made up. I said, no.
You did it at the church?
I did it at the church. I said, my mother did a lot of drugs.
Yeah.
She finally gets hired at the welfare office, and she gets fired. She was like last hired, first fired. And he said, would you like to grab some lunch? I'm like, all right. And he said, your dad, you joke about the LSD. And I said, no, that's really true. And then he's an intriguing, very intriguing.
Yeah.
And then his friend Dennis Wolfberg died, and he was kind of fond of me. I could tell it. And I was like, this is really fucked up. I'm attracted to him, but this is fucked up. But this is, you know, and I couldn't think straight because it was like so taboo that it was exciting, but so taboo that it was
awful. Because he was the club owner?
He was a club owner. He was also
he
was also a father figure I never had. He also was emotionally removed, which made me associate love with longing. He like had the trifecta of being the perfect kind of messed upness for me to just want.
But he wasn't explosive, was he?
No, he was just, no, but it was his way or the...
Withdrawn.
Withdrawn and removed, and I just would win, my love would win him over.
Just
I would
kind of pounding at the door?
Yes.
Yeah.
I would win him over. But, yeah, when we first moved in together, he said, I said, listen, I chain smoke, I'm on the phone a lot, it takes me a couple hours to dry my hair, but other than that, I have a really effervescent personality. Now, is there anything I ought to know about you? Like, keep the toilet seat up, you clip your toenails in bed.
Yeah.
And he goes, if you disappoint me in any way, I will withhold all my love from you. Like,
and you're like, great.
Great. And I was like, and I was literally, great. I'm moving in. I will not disappoint.
So you're doing comedy a couple of years.
2 years,
And then you get seen by who?
Get seen by Amy and Tricasso Davis. I had a huge showcase at Caroline's.
Uh-huh.
She was supposed to be at the Montreal Comedy Festival. Tony Camacho was my manager.
Right.
And I said, you know, Tony, I want to work on some new stuff. It was the first time I was at Caroline's that ever had so many laughs in my life. I didn't even, like, I've seen the original tape. When you look at it, I'm just registering getting so many laughs.
Yeah.
And there was a joy. Like, we lose that.
Yeah.
Have you ever, like, watched your sets when there's joyfulness?
Yeah.
And then you're trying to be so technically proficient and nail your bits and get that. You forget to smile.
Right.
You know what you love?
Sure.
So.
It was a good night.
It was a great night.
And she was there?
Amy and Tricasso Davis said, we sent out a flyer to 500 people. She was the one. And she said, I was the one person that didn't go up to Montreal Comedy Festival. She goes, I want to see you in my office. In 2 weeks, your entire life's going to be different.
Yeah.
So I bring my contract into my temp place. I'm like, they really like me. And I don't even take it seriously. And she says, she takes the tape. I take this work tape never knowing that that work tape was going to get me 60 meetings in all of Los Angeles. And Drew Carey.
But you fly out here?
Fly out to
for
LA.
For meetings.
For meetings.
And these are for.
Meeting after meeting.
To get a development deal.
They all want to give me development deals. Yeah. They all want to.
Right.
And I feel like Cinderella.
Uh-huh.
Like, I didn't know what was happening to me. And Jeff Abagov, who's out there, he wrote this show called The Billy Club. Carsey Warner said, please go into business with us. And all I knew is how to be loyal.
Yeah.
It's like you go with, you don't just, I didn't know a bird in the hand is better than two in the, I didn't know a lot. If I would have known what I knew now, I wouldn't have been, but I just thought loyalty. So Drew Carey, NBC.
So you're going out with the guy who's on my porch right now with his show, and Carsey Warner wants
to
do it?
No, they're just bringing him in as a writer.
Okay.
Carsey Warner's like...
They got a show.
Yeah, we got a show, The Billy Club, which he wrote. They said, just stay with us, Vanessa.
Oh, and okay. They offered you the deal.
They offered me the deal. They said, we'll give you $100,000.
Right.
And we're taking you off the market. I had a meeting at NBC. They said, look at this Drew Carey show. Here's the pilot.
Right.
We'll write you a sixth lead and give you $260,000. Just please, we want you to be with us.
Yeah.
And Carsey Warner's like, I'm going to give you the third lead and we love you.
Yeah.
And I'd never like, this is someone who didn't know love from, like I didn't.
You didn't have any representation?
I had Tony Camacho.
No agent.
I had no agent. Tony Camacho. And Tony Camacho wasn't sure who to talk to. And I felt like Lenny and George of Mice and Men, I swear to God. And I didn't know what was happening. And I just thought, just hold it together. And I turned down the Drew Carey show. I remember seeing it thinking Kathy was funny, the one with all the makeup. Yeah. Drew, I thought he reminded me of like Clark Kent. Like it wasn't, but the Billy Club was a cop show.
Yeah.
I knew I wanted to be a cop. And then that show never happened. And then everyone in New York was a little bit jealous of me. There were some well-known comedians that were like, oh, she does that performance art shit, whatever she does. Or she's fucking the owner, or, you know, whatever nasty things.
Right, you were doing characters and you were dating Lucian and you got this deal for $100,000.
I wasn't quite dating him, but everybody knew he liked me.
I remember that.
There was stuff going on.
Well, I remember the reaction. It was more about like, you know, you don't even doing it, right? You didn't pay your dues. Yeah, you know, how does she get that 2 years in?
Right.
Who is she? Doesn't even work at the real clubs.
Right.
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 So
and then Lucian wanted to be out with us. I'm like, Lucian, I have everything to prove. There's not one, I will say we're together when I'm passed in every single club and it's on my terms. You won't say you're in love with me.
This is after you started dating?
Yeah.
But so what happens to the deal? So you come back with your $100,000.
Come back. No, I give him back. I said, just take me off of this. Here, you can have like 40 or 60.
What?
Gave it back.
What do you mean you gave it back?
I just gave him back their money.
Why?
They wouldn't let me audition for anything. I was just sitting there, pilot after pilot after pilot.
Oh, they had a hold on you?
Yes.
For a year?
I said, just get me out of this deal. And that's when I auditioned for... Suddenly Susan, I was back to back with Janine Garofalo. They were like, you're not quite Janine, you're not quite Kathy Griffin, you're kind of in between. And they got stuff, and I went from being, you know, hot to ice cold. And that's when Lucian said, well, you're gonna have to make yourself undeniably funny now.
Yeah.
I said, but I am funny. He goes, no, no, you're gonna be funny. And that was, I said, but surely I'll get another chance. And he goes, you might not. But he said, you will always be able to do this till the day you die.
Stand up.
I'm like, what, nursing? He goes, provided you don't get Alzheimer's or lose your mind or urinate all over yourself, you will always have a skill.
Yeah.
He just had such a way of, I said, thank you, Lucian. You think I might not, maybe I want to teach art or something.
So you come back, you're beaten up, the comedy community is
and they're all
judgmental.
Friendly. Oh no, now
oh,
they're
no.
like
oh, yeah.
they're like Vanessa. We've got our own back. Nice beginning failure, piece of fucking shit. Now you're gonna be funny.
Right. And you were.
Yeah.
You got funny. And you started dating Lucian.
Started dating Lucian.
You got passed at the cellar and the improv.
Got passed at the cellar and I was the one, was the few.
And you started living with him?
Started living with him. And he already had scleroderma. And
I just remember, I can't remember. I thought it was lupus that he had.
No, he had horrible, horrible scleroderma.
What is that exactly?
Hardening of the skin. Scleroderma is like Greek, and what happens is your skin overproduces collagen.
But how did he lose his fingers?
He couldn't get circulation because the blood got cut. This was like, scleroderma is everything gets so tight here.
Oh my God.
And he said, he described the pain. He said, if you play baseball, he goes, my fingers are so delicate that if I was playing softball and a softball was going to hit me in the crotch as a man, I would let it hit me in the crotch before I would try and grab it.
Because it would knock his fingers off? Oh my God.
No, it just hurt too much.
Oh.
And I used to always try to find gloves for him, started cooking for him, but I was now, I hadn't been in AA for years. I had no desire to drink. He didn't even think I had a drinking problem.
Yeah.
He thought I had a lot of other problems. And I remember that I started to take antidepressants, which I knew nothing about.
Yeah.
And I started to go up and up, because then he'd howl like a wild animal at night. This is when there was a secret life delusion that no one knew.
The sickness.
The sickness and the fragileness of him, which he kept hidden.
Yeah.
And I kept it hidden for him.
Yeah.
But he would howl like a wild animal. And I said, you've got to get some help.
Yeah.
And we researched the fentanyl patch, which he didn't have addiction issues. Yeah. I did. I had no issues with that. And I noticed that I watched a tape and I was no longer myself. Like
You were consumed by his sickness.
I was consumed by his sickness, but I lost my soul. I was watching myself do a set. So I'm like, I wanted to do the Comedy Central Presents.
Yeah.
And I watched one of my sets and I'm like, there's no soul. My soul's gone. This medication is.
Oh, the antidepressants.
But I wasn't crying. I'd bandage him up. Yeah. He'd howl. Go, okay, Lucian, here. Like, music, I wasn't affected by music, sunsets, nothing mattered. It was just.
And you thought it was the medication?
I knew it was the medication, but I didn't realize that it was now taking my personality. So I went, we were now starting to have marital problems.
When did you get married?
We got married. Well, he didn't want to get married. He'd already been married twice. And Michelle, his old wife, and I used to work in the office together. We got married 14 months before he died.
So you're having marital problems?
Marital problems. And I tried to get pregnant. I had a miscarriage. And then I had the miscarriage. And I was like the beginning of how many cruel jokes is God going to play? And how many times do I have to fake it till you make it?
Yeah.
Put your best foot forward. Yeah. Keep a stiff upper lip.
Yeah.
And I just started to get angry at God. I'm like, everything that I'm willing to work. Everything that mattered is just take from me. And I remember they had a tour of the Middle East, and I remember saying, I have to do something life-affirming now. And I'd lost the baby, I had the miscarriage, like I had it in my hand, like it looked like a heart, like it was just, and Lucian was, I'm sorry, honey, you know, it's not meant to be. I would have loved to have been a father, but with this debilitating disease, it might have been too much. And I went to the Middle East.
On a comedy tour.
And then we were newly married and we were starting to have problems.
How was the Middle East?
It was one of the most happiest times I'd ever had in my life performing for these guys. And I knew some of them wouldn't come back.
Oh, it was a USO?
It was one of the first tours that went out with them. And I was there for a month.
Wow.
And we were newly married and I was trying to get a hold of him to tell him I loved him. And he would be, that's so sweet, honey. I'm 2-for-1 in golf. I'm doing very well. Like, his golf game was more important than me loving him.
He couldn't ever get out of that detachment.
And when I came, and this is where we differed, and this is where I learned about men and women. when I came home, I wanted to surprise him. I knew how hard it was for him to drive.
Yeah.
So he was going to pick me up. And I wanted him to, like, see me, throw me on the floor, make wild, passionate love. And he was like, oh, you're home. Ah, good. I wasn't expecting this. And I was like, I was gone for him. And I remember...
You surprised him, you mean?
I surprised him, hoping he'd be like, oh, Vanessa, yes. My wife, I love you.
Yeah.
How was it? And he was like, oh. Well, I was right in the middle of putting up some paintings of yours. And, well, you just surprised me. Yeah. You know, I don't like surprise. I'm like... Oh. And that was our disconnect. And I remember we had a huge fight. And I just slammed the door and broke, shattered all this glass.
He had like
and I was waiting for him to just go, you just immature child.
Yeah.
And he sat me down and he said, Vanessa, there's a difference between a demand and a request. And if you could just accept me for being who I am, I might surprise you by doing some of the things you might like. And you did everything to be the perfect wife for me.
Yeah.
Did you ever ask yourself if I was the perfect man for you? And I never did. I was so busy wanting to be the perfect wife for him.
Uh-huh.
And then as he was getting sicker and sicker, you know, our love changed. He was the one that protected me.
Yeah.
I was now the one protecting him.
Right.
And that was when, you know, that was when I ended up going off on the deep end with drink. I didn't know what an alcoholic I was. I had no idea.
After he died or during?
After he died.
So, you know, you were there till the end, you know, next to him. And you were in the room when he passed?
Yeah. We were having marital problems, so I wanted the last 6 months, he got told to put his papers in order, and I wanted to move back with him. We only separated for a few months, because I said, can we get couples counseling? And he goes, you knew I was going to die when you married me. You knew that.
Uh-huh.
And I said, but I'm on medication. He goes, well, that's not my problem. I didn't tell you to medicate yourself. I'm like, but it's really, I said, this is like Lois W and Bill W. He goes, but we're not, and I'm not. And just, Vanessa, things get tough and you just run away. Just go run, run, run. And I just wanted him to get a little therapy. That's all I wanted was some marital counseling so he could understand that this was killing me.
Yeah.
And then my therapist said, he's on the tail end, Vanessa. He's getting ready to die.
Yeah.
You're everything to live. You guys are not. So I called up his friends and I said, listen, make him food, help him drive, be there. I can't do that. And do not tell him I told you to do anything.
Yeah.
I have not, you didn't hear these phone calls. So I didn't want him to have his dignity.
Yeah.
Didn't want him to know that I was doing anything behind his back. So they were making him food. Certain people were sucking up to him, and he knew it. He goes, you know, if they're nice to me now, I just pass them. It's kind of sad. I used to pass people because they were funny. Now you make me soup, and I'll give you a Tuesday night.
Yeah.
But he was starting to get like, the giant was beginning.
Yeah.
To like, it's like the old dog was beginning to...
Break down. And he's getting humble.
He's getting humble.
Vulnerability to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It made me just get so protective. And
so you came back.
I can't. No, this was what killed me. I said, Lucian, I really think I should come back. We don't have to have sex.
Yeah.
That's all right. We really couldn't by now.
Right.
I said, I'll sleep on the couch.
Yeah.
Sleep with you.
Yeah.
I really don't care. You need some. And he goes, I've never been so happy. I'm in pain, but comedians visit me. They bring me food. They talk to me. I hold court here. I said, If you come back, all that'll be taken away. And I thought, I know what it feels like to shine. And he had his moment. He let so many other people shine. And I was like, okay. So I was like, that's...
And you had gotten that stuff going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then I knew I was at the Borgata. And I'm now seeing him, like, I'm helping him do the schedule. He's like, honey, you could do the schedule yourself. Right. And I'm like, I knew that if I stopped waking him up, he would have no reason to live.
Right.
So my instinct was just keep him alive.
Yeah.
So I called the Borgata. I'm at the Borgata. I'm like, Lucian, I'm on my way home. And he's like, I'm so in love with my wife. I'm like, this is what I'm used to. I'm like, can you remember to... I picked up some Diet Snapple for, like, this was not him. And I'm like, the days are numbered. They knew it. And I was with Tom Carter. I'm like, I've got to get home. And Monday, he was going to do the schedule and see the auditioners. And I remember he was, like, throwing up, like yogurt. And he'd gotten, now he's about 130 pounds, skinny. And they brought the auditions. They had a camera rigged up in his... So, I said, Lucian, you want to see the auditioners? And he's like, no, just stop hassling me, Vanessa. Just stop it. Just let me sleep. I was like, no, this is the third time I've gotten yelled at by somebody I loved right before they die.
Yeah.
And I said, all right. And that Tuesday, when we had to go do the schedule, I knew something was off. So I said, he loves old movies. Let me leave the old movies on. Let me leave the lights on just so when he wakes up, he won't feel alone because something's off here. And then Tuesday, he was in his chair. His legs were open. He was wearing like a burgundy bathrobe and like this. But his legs were always closed. And I was like, Lucian, I'm here to do the schedule. Like, you really do go into denial when someone dies.
Yeah.
You don't, like, your body, you actually, I'm like, let's do the schedule. Lucian, wake up.
Yeah.
And I called Lenny Marcus. And I said, Lenny, he's not responding. You got to, like, come over here.
Yeah.
And Lenny was, he's gone. He's gone. I said, please, you can't leave me here.
He came over?
Yeah. And then there was comedians calling. And then they immediately wanted to do the schedule who was ever running the comic strip. And I'll never forget this one comedian. He's like, I was wondering if I could switch spots. And I'm like, it's a little hard right now because Lucian just died. And he's like, oh, fuck. I'll call later. Calls 2 hours later. Is it? I'm like, this is so fucking comic. All right, I'm sorry, but can you switch a spot with me?
So that was horrible.
That was pretty bad. I thought I had grief drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And when he died, he was taking, I remember, like, I'd already, like, I hadn't really drunk in years.
Yeah.
Didn't really take pills. No, I'd never, all those years, it's like I started drinking when he died at 44.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, giving him a Percocet and thinking, okay, that's for your pain. This is for emotional pain.
Oh, really?
Pain.
You were doing that?
I was already doing that. Yeah. Like, if you had a... And I remember Lisa Ann Walter was with me one day. She took Lucian to dinner. She's like, 3 fucking hours to eat with that guy. I'm like, yeah. She's like, wow. Because he would eat everything so... like everything, and the joys he got was being able to eat. So I learned how to cook food really well. He loved wine sauce. He wished I drank. And I'll never forget saying, I don't know what the big deal is, wine. It tastes disgusting.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, getting ready to make the sauce.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, fuck, shit. You know, just in the pain. And I couldn't. And I remember going like that.
Taking the bottle.
Taking a big glass and drank it down. And I'm like, it was as if like everything became like the yellow brick road. Yeah. All of a sudden,
yeah,
everything stopped hurting.
Uh-huh.
And I had this huge smile on my face and I was like, here's your dinner, Lucian.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I had a glass and I was like, I finally.
Yeah,
and I'm drinking. There was not happiness.
No, you're scared.
It's like you're drinking. I'm like, yeah. And his look was
terrified.
Terrified. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do without you. And he goes, I don't know what you're going to do without me either. And I didn't know that one glass of wine.
Yeah.
Was going to be 2.5 bottles a day.
Yeah. And that's where you ended up.
I ended up, I didn't know that you couldn't mix pills with booze. And I was at Broadway.
Comedy
Club?
I do
this hip-hop thing.
Yeah.
Where I usually pull my pants down and I do a hip-hop version of the Beatles rap.
Yeah.
And I usually pull my pants down and show my ass. And I'd taken the Valium, the antidepressants, the alcohol. I go up on stage and the words are like, I'm looking with the words are like, I can't get the words out, but I know. And I'm like, this is really wrong. And the audience I'm seeing going like this.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh no. Expression's changing and now they're terrified. And
like, and the mop top and my dress, I pulled down my entire underwear, skirt, like,
yeah,
completely exposed. And Dustin Chafin,
yeah,
gets me off stage. And there was this guy, Paulie, and Paulie said, get this girl a cab. And you can hear, she's nothing but a drunk. She's a loser. She's nothing but a fucking drunk. And Paulie said, this girl has more heart and talent in her finger than any of you fucks.
Who said you were nothing but a drunk?
These comedians, no recollection. I was so, the next thing I knew, I was spread on my floor with the keys and then I have no recollection how I even got home. And then I thought that no one would know what a problem I might have had. So I called Chris Mazzilli and I said, you know, I think I've been taking a little too much, you know, pain. I think I'm allergic to some of these allergy medications. Yeah. Like, really?
And what did Mazzilli say?
Goes, well, it's good, Vanessa, you know, just, we worried about, you know, what was wrong. You know, I was mixing the, so I got off of all the pills.
So he was good. He was worried about you.
Al Martin gave me another chance. Everyone gave me another chance.
So how long were you all fucked up?
I was fucked. That's when it started to cost me. I was fucked up probably for that year. And then I started trying to get sober and I couldn't stop.
Where were you living?
I was living on 28th Street and 8th. I moved out of Lucian's place. I couldn't live there.
Did he leave you anything?
Yeah. Yeah, he left me. He told this to Corey. He didn't tell me. So
to
similar
Kahaney?
To my dad. Goes, Vanessa gave me the happiest years of my entire life in spite of this debilitating disease. And Corey was crying. And I was like, Corey, why didn't he ever tell me that? She goes, I don't know, but he told me. And I wish I knew what it felt like to be loved like that, Vanessa. Someone loved you like that. I said, I wish.
You knew. Right?
Yeah, I'll just tell her the last moment by somebody else.
Yeah.
That'll fuck her up and make her a little bit funnier.
Right.
I don't know. So parents always think they're doing you a favor, making you tougher.
Right, sure. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to understand the dynamics that we seek out. And
I used to laugh about your mom, the anorexic.
Yeah. Yeah, well, she's still at it.
Oh, God. I remember hearing you talk so honestly and just thinking, wow, it's like there was so much heart in what you said. I remember one time I was watching you. I don't even think you remember this. I just really, I loved the fact that you were full of energy, but full of energy and self-deprecating. You'd always sit on a stool and you had like some, reminded me a little bit of John Lennon and yeah. You know, that kind of thing. And I'll never forget, I was sitting right here and I was getting ready to watch you and you went, Vanessa Hollingshead. Now that's intimidating. And I remember thinking, I said, how would I ever intimidate you? And I said, I'm here for you because you're brilliant. And you're like, all right. I just never forget that.
Well, you're very intense, you know? You're very intense. So...
Unlike you.
Right. I know. Well, that's why I connected.
I thought we were going to be talking cats.
Really?
Yeah, I really did. That's all right.
So, but did you... Well, how long did it take you to get it together? How far did you fall?
I'll never forget. I was on stage, and now I was drinking a little bit more. Now I was drinking in the morning.
You?
Yeah. Like wine.
Yeah.
And I was with a pothead, so he'd get high. And this was months, I couldn't even, like, I was undateable. I'd be talking, I'd be out on a date, start talking about Lucian, and I'd just start crying.
Yeah.
And so... The drinking just began to escalate, but I started to drink very well. I started to not check my texts, you know, do not write things on Facebook because you think you're poetic.
Yeah.
Do not drunk text boyfriends.
You had
a
list of rules?
I had a list of rules and post-its, and I would always, always like have my cats, me and the cats.
How many cats did you have then?
Two. We had 20 and 21, two brothers, uh-huh. Kept them around.
And so, how'd you hit bottom? What happened?
It was almost like the cat. I'll never forget. Like I vowed never to be like. I was always the sad sap. I was either very flirtatious, or just start crying. And I'll never forget. I came in, and my cat would either be in my drawer, keeping me company, or be on the tape, would be on the chair.
Yeah.
And I drunk too much, and I just went to go. Shoo the cat. I was always so gentle with him, and I remember the cat just the little leg, like the little leg. Just his cat was fine, but the little leg like just went like that.
Yeah,
and that was my mom. I'm like, no, it's one thing that I self destruct, but I'm not taking that cat with me.
Oh, you hurt its leg?
I thought I hurt its leg. I didn't, but it was enough. Yeah, and I just grabbed it to me, and I started sobbing. And I started going to AA. And that wouldn't work. That didn't work either. And now I was getting scared. Then I was getting time and losing time and getting time. Like, wait a second.
Anyone helping you, any of the guys? Nobody.
No one.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I just thought you go to AA and you don't want to drink.
No.
Then I had to take antabuse. And I'll never forget. I would drink like this if I was drinking.
Yeah.
You would not know it. I learned how to take the mouth spray, smile, keep a distance. Like you learn all these little secret rules.
Yeah.
But I wasn't fooling myself. And I remember I had all these women that came that weren't drinking. And I knew I had a drink. I put out a beautiful, like, lunch for them. And I went into the bathroom and I filled up all my wine in a hairspray bottle. And I undid the hairspray bottle. And I'm looking at myself in the mirror, drinking the hairspray bottle. I'm like, you might. I think you've got a problem. And then my psychiatrist, he tried the Campril, tried this antidepressant, he tried this thing, and I just thought, there's one drug left, antabuse, where you can die if you drink on it. And I said, you've got to put me on antabuse. And he goes, you'll die.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm dying now.
Yeah.
And I said, it was 9 a.m. I said, do you think I had anything to drink? And he was a substance specialist. Yeah. He's like, no. I said, I've already had half a bottle of white wine. And I remember he wrote the script.
He wrote the script.
Goes, now, I want you to wear a bracelet that I want it to jingle.
Yeah.
So when you think that you can drink, you'll hear the jingling.
That you might die.
And it saved my life. And I'll never forget like day 4 or 5, looking out the window and thinking, you can eat 2 cakes, you can fuck somebody, you can tell someone to fuck off.
Right.
You can just take your clothes off. You can do, you cannot drink.
Right.
And then I was like, thank you. Thank you, God. Thank you. And then I ended up going to a rehab in Australia.
Uh-huh.
And this was like the Harry Potter of rehabs. This was like, this was, it's like, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, I'm a manic depressive, I'm a compulsive cleaner. I'm like, yeah. God, why couldn't I be a compulsive cleaner? Everything we fucking need, not destroy my career.
Yeah. How long were you there?
I was there a month. It saved my life. And I was very, I didn't believe in God. When I came back, there was no, I remember praying to Bill W.
Yeah.
I remember having the drink.
Yeah.
I remember being drunk one night and saying, well, Lucian, if you didn't think I was a drunk when you knew me, I'm a fucking drunk now.
Yeah.
Think I might have a problem or not.
Yeah.
Think I just have some emotional problems.
Uh-huh. You showed him.
Yeah, I show. Good, I'll show you. Let me drink. Yes, I know, we do that. They told me in the rehab, they said, you might not be able to be a comedian again if you put yourself at risk.
Yeah.
And that I couldn't. Now, I had almost no money left. And this was the turning point for me. Bruce Smirnoff was working at Royal.
The comedian, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Working at Royal Caribbean. He said, you know, I book ships. I book the biggest cruise ships in the world. You're kind of edgy, but we'll give you a shot. And I was down to nothing. I remember putting in four applications to Starbucks,
yeah.
Thinking, well, Louis C.K. might walk in there and you're going to have to make him a latte and then you can go back to hating God because now this is going to be cruel joke.
Not
number,
sure,
whatever.
Not sure Louis could help you now.
No. I wouldn't have a problem in doing anything inappropriate. I'd be like, Louis, do what you got to do. I'm so over this shit. Just put me on your show. Just don't get my hair.
Yeah. So you're applying at Starbucks and Smirnoff, what, calls you?
Yeah, I'm applying for a thing at Starbucks. I'm like, okay, I guess this is, you know, this is the new thing in my life. I'll just be making coffees and famous people walk in there and I'll make one hell of a latte.
That's going to be my break.
That'll be my break.
Finally, my second break.
And this is God obviously wants me as humble as they fucking come. And this is, thank you, God. Uh-huh. I will just go become a nun.
Yeah.
And then Bruce said, so I put all the applications in. Bruce said, can you come down to Florida? They want to audition you. I'm like, Bruce, I can't even pay my rent right now. It's like, oh. Well, they don't usually accept comics, especially, you know, you're a woman. They don't know you. And I'm like, I just got to get at Starbucks. And then he said, this is strange. This was a day later now. This was literally a day later. He goes, you know what? 12 people saw your drinking set, and it's edgy. You got the ship. One word of advice. Don't fuck up. And that was 3.5 years ago.
The drinking set. That was about what?
That was about drinking. Just say my friends tried so many interventions with me. I just used to leave the plastic folding chairs set up in a semicircle in my apartment. They came over.
So you've been doing ships for a few years? A
few years. Then I started back with the acting. Then I just finished doing the vagina monologues.
Great.
I started to go back with the acting. I started to do yoga. I gave up smoking. Gave up sugar, weed, and flour.
Wow.
Basically, well, I'd kind of given up sex, but that was just you can't meet anyone in New York.
Uh-huh.
They're all gay. And I mean, I love gay guys, but they're all, you've been to New York.
Uh-huh.
A lot of pretty women, a lot of gay guys.
Really? You can't meet anybody in New York, on the entire island, anywhere?
I try.
All right. Where are you living?
28th and 8th.
Mm. Well, I'm very happy for you. It's a very great conversation. I'm all choked up.
I'm so amazing. Like, I listened to all your podcasts, and I was like, God, I hope I'm good. He's so good.
What are you talking about?
You made my week.
Oh,
like,
good.
You made my month.
Good. Well, I'm so happy you're okay.
You're wonderful.
You are. That was a great story. I really enjoyed talking to you.
I really enjoyed being here.
That was some story. Huh? Great to talk to her. I'm very happy we did that. I feel like we needed it. I feel like it was, I don't know. There's just some people you're like, how's she doing? And that's how she's doing, and she's doing okay, and it was great to see her. I'll play a little guitar. It's just the same guitar. It's all self-contained, so you'll never have to do any installing or upgrading. But if you do have a question, Squarespace's award-winning 24/7 customers... Cunt! But if you do have a question, Squarespace... Oh, you fucking ball sucker. But if you do have a question, Squarespace's award-winning 24/7 customer... Oh, no.